All right, 3, 2, 1. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On tonight's show, I have a very special guest. He comes to us from the UK. His name is James Riley. He published a book a couple years ago. The title of the book is The Bad Trip, Dark Omens, New Worlds, and the End of the 60s. It's a fascinating book. It really goes in detail on many aspects of that tumultuous decade, things that I didn't know about. So I learned a lot reading the book, which I finished this morning. Mr. Riley is the Muriel Bradbook Official Fellow of English Literature at Girton College, Cambridge, which is one of the 31 constituent colleges of the University of Cambridge, where he works on modern and contemporary literature, popular film, and 1960s culture. He's widely published and has written for The Times, The I, Big Issue North, 14 Times, Vertigo, Monolith, and One-on-One, and his blog is titled Residual Noise. So, Mr. Riley, are you there?
I'm here, William. Thank you for having me. How
awesome.
Are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for agreeing to the interview. For people who may not have heard you here in the States or familiar with you, can you talk a little bit about your background and what kind of led you into this book, The Bad Trip?
Yeah, absolutely. No problem. Well, as I said, thanks for having me and hello to everyone who's listening. Thanks for tuning in. My name's James Riley. I am I'm a fellow of English at Girton. So my kind of disciplinary background is English studies, English literature, but I've always been interested in the more modern and contemporary material with an emphasis, I guess, on the undertows, the things that are sort of somehow left off the map. I'm interested in what puts things to margins, how kind of counter trends emerge. I'm very interested in popular culture and how literature sort of soaks up ideas from what we might call the fringes. I suppose that's what I'm generally interested in, researching and teaching literature. So my training is in English literature as a discipline. In terms of interested in the 1960s, it is always something I've been interested in from quite a young age. I grew up listening to loads of really great 60s music, very much thanks to my father's record collection, which I think is a way that lots of people get into that kind of music. And I grew up also during what in the UK is called the sort of Britpop era, sort of 90s, which when there were all kinds of bands like Oasis and Blur were very popular at the time. And I, growing up and being interested in that, I was always kind of fascinated by the sort of origins of that and where the reference points were. And I thought, I guess these were my sort of entryways into it. And at the time, as a teenager, there was also a program on both the radio and the TV in the UK called Sounds of the 60s, a kind of BBC show, which showed loads of really great clips from the 1960s, played loads of really great music on the radio each weekend. And I was always really interested in the way that tonally it would move really quickly from a kind of sparky, bubbly pop to really quite dark and sort of strange material, and how that tonal shift could also be in the career of the same kind of band. You know, bands like the Rolling Stones, bands like the Beatles, they seem to move through these arcs across the decade from sort of poppy kind of material, bubblegum almost pop, to really quite strange, often discordant, almost semi-apocalyptic images. And that always really interested me, and the way in which they would coexist very easily interested me a lot, almost if this wasn't really a dark side, like a kind of, it wasn't really an alternative. It was somehow inscribed into the culture of the 60s itself. And I think the moment that always seems to come to mind was on these clip shows from music shows and Top of the Pops and all this other kind of stuff. You'd have things like the New Seekers, and then very quickly followed by footage of people like the Crazy World of Arthur Brown talking about being the God of Hellfire with his head on fire. And this was right there on this was right there in some tea time mainstream TV. And you don't then have to look very far to find sort of roots of that and reflections of that in what we might call an avant-garde and an underground, filmmakers like Kenneth Anger, we might talk about later on. So the coexistence, I think, of the light and the dark in the culture of the 1960s, the way in which that had proliferated into almost a kind of nostalgia industry of the 60s, which of course was my way into it. I'm not a direct witness of this. I'm very much very sort of transparent about the fact that this is an engagement with a certain degree of nostalgia, but a certain tonality of it. So I really wanted to sort of, as the opportunity came to do this book and as the ideas sort of began to cohere together, I really wanted to, in some ways, tell the stories of that tonal shift across the decade, this sense that there was some kind of decline taking place, this sort of movement, this one particular understanding of the decade as a movement towards catastrophe, sort of tell the story of that, question it a little bit, reflect on it and sort of hopefully reflect on what that actually might ultimately say about the decade, because seeing the 60s as a decade that sort of inexorably declines into disaster and seeing it almost in tragic terms, it seems to me that that's another way of highlighting its exceptional nature. It was another way of saying how sort of exceptional and superb this decade is, because what else is there to expect of the 1960s than this almost sort of glorious supernova-like explosion right at the end of it? It seems the most appropriate end in the sort of popular memory of the 1960s, because obviously the alternative to that is the thing that's probably harder to think about, which is the kind of unexceptional movement into suburbia, beigeness, and the 70s, which right. is probably the greater tragedy of it.
I mean, it's an incredible era because that decade is so much different than the 50s. And then I think you really capture in your book that growth of this promise of the 60s, but also this kind of shadow or dark side or spectral mm-hmm. element that yeah. By 69, there was so much change in other people's ideas. What do you think that what brought about this change or this kind of darker element of the 60s, which you titled The Bad Trip? What do you think brought that about?
Well, in one sense, you can see it as a sort of failed utopianism. You can see it as a kind of inevitable short-termism of a lot of very promising ideas. If you think about what we might refer to as the so-called counterculture, broadly understood, in both the UK and America, as I'm sure most of your listeners are aware, you had this bringing together of lots of very dynamic forces on the basis of the newly educated young post-war generation. But a lot of those projections and a lot of those hopes and a lot of those aspirations seem to revolve around the idea of youth, which is always going to be transient and temporary, which is always going to be difficult to sustain. So even at its most utopian, there's a kind of temporiness to it. There's a short-termism to it, which I think invites a certain kind of sense of decline, a kind of withering, but and a sense that something is running out, even if it turns into something else. So I think the youth element of it has got a lot to do with it. I think there is also a political shift at the same time. You can chart a shift, certainly within the left wing, from a sort of non-violent mode of protest to a much more aggressive, a much more militant sense of direct political action. And in some sense, that comes from a frustration within the left itself, a kind of impatience, a kind of a desire to widen the targets. But it is also coming, if you like, in response to the reaction on the part of, quote-unquote, the establishment. Because I think this is also something we sort of need to keep in mind when we're thinking about the political and cultural situation of the 1960s. Whilst we sort of zero in on that decade as this period of emancipation and liberation in all kinds of ways, it's shot through with violence. It's shot through with discourse all the way through the decade. This is a decade which sort of in some ways begins with a spectacular assassination, and it is suffused with global violence. So it's an extremely discordant phase. And in some ways, those kind of utopian hopes were there and sparkling in terms of their emphasis on love, because the world seemed to be sorely lacking it at the time.
Right.
Say again, sorry.
Just sorry to interrupt, but it's like Vietnam, the backdrop of nuclear bombs or nuclear Holocaust is really right around the corner. So these people are operating within that environment, I mean, in a sociological sense. And maybe you can talk a little about people maybe in the States don't know as much about this guy, Natal. You titled one of your chapters Bomb Culture. Can you talk a little bit about him and his impact?
Yeah, Jeff Nuttall, who wrote a book called Bomb Culture in the late 1960s. And I think this kind of encapsulates what I was kind of implying, the fact that when we think about the sort of currency of love, for example, and the way in which that gets a kind of a lot of emphasis placed on it in the decade, it's not just an invitation to hedonism, if you like. It's not just an invitation and a kind of relaxing into pleasure. It's there in the sense of there is a real humanitarian need in the period. This is a decade which is consumed with a kind of nuclear anxiety, and it's consumed with images of violence and a sense of violence. And Nuttall was really picking up on this. Jeff Nuttall was an artist and a poet and a teacher and an educator who was very much engaged with the London-based, the word that they were using at the time was underground, but we might refer to it as a kind of UK arm of the American counterculture. He was involved in a newspaper called International Times, a kind of underground newspaper. And he was also involved in a sort of series of kind of often very violent, often quite scatological performance pieces in and around London. And then in his later years, he returned to the northwest of England, where he's originally from, but carried on writing, producing poetry. One thing that is maintained throughout his poetry is this image, a very sort of visceral, corporeal, often very violent imagery. And it's not so much violent imagery in the sense of a kind of assertive, aggressive desire to attack others. It's imagery of the body often in pain. It's imagery of the body undergoing some kind of transformation. It's the body moving out of its sort of parameters. And he, whilst he was writing this poetry and developing this imagery, he was also producing a sort of little magazine that he called My Own Mag, his own sort of publication. And he was publishing American poets. He was publishing Allen Ginsberg. He was one of the first to publish William Burroughs in the UK. And the pages of My Own Mag are slashed. They're split apart. He would cut them. He would burn them. And there's something there as a reflection of William Burroughs' cut-up ideas and cut-up technique about getting language to say things in a very serendipitous way. But on the same level, it's also the sense that, you know, for him, kind of language can't really bear the brunt of these horrors that he's seeing around him. He was acutely aware of the visceral images of Vietnam, the impact of napalm, the impact of seeing those first images of street executions, of piles of bodies. He's also coming out of the Second World War with all the associated imagery there, and also the great nuclear shadow. He refers to the generation as being napalm, a sort of post-napalm, post-Hiroshima generation. So for Nuttall, the appropriate response is to kind of really sort of foreground this sense of violence. And it's not nihilistic. It's not misanthropic. It's actually deeply humanitarian in the sense of he's really trying to convey the sort of injustice and kind of humanistic horror at the way in which the military-industrial complex, geopolitics, global war is really sort of violating the human form. So in his book Bomb Culture, it becomes a kind of primer of a lot of these ideas that you can see in his poetry, but it's also a sort of autobiographical movement through the UK underground, where he's sort of pushing against and questioning instances where he's not really, from his perspective, he's not really seeing enough kind of emphasis on this sense of horror, this sense of atrocity. So he's often trying to punch at what he sees as hypocrisy. He's often trying to argue against moments of what he sees as being ineffective political action. And it's also like a clarion call for a sense of disgust. Nuttall would say that, you know, people need to be kind of more disgusted, more kind of outraged, more kind of horrified. Again, not as a way of sort of glorying in the negative, but to become aware of precisely what is happening in the world. So he's a figure who's often quite provocative, often quite difficult, and he's often seen as someone who seems to be interested in shock for shock's sake. But buried within that, there's a profound kind of love and respect for the human form, and it's a body of work which is defined by outrage.
Right. And another person who pops up in that chapter who I didn't know much about, his name is Peter Whitehead, and he's kind of like an observer of all of these events that happened in the 60s, not just in the, from the UK, but while he was in the US. Can you talk about the importance of Peter Whitehead?
Yeah, I was really trying to make a point about Peter Whitehead because you probably see that he's, I kind of come back to his story quite a few times over the course of the book, and we sort of chart him through the 1960s and into the 70s, and he's a figure who sort of embodies the narrative that I've been trying to get at. He's a filmmaker, he's a documentary filmmaker. He's originally from Liverpool, and then he becomes the sort of classic post-war scholarship boy. He finds himself in the Slade School of Art in the early 1960s, gets involved in film, gets involved in documentary films, cinema verite, and then he's sort of big break once he moves through the sort of journeyman experience of making pop promos and newsreels and so on and so forth. He gets the opportunity to film a large-scale poetry reading in the Albert Hall in 1965, at which Allen Ginsberg and lots of other American and British
poets. Ferlinghetti.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti, yeah.
Passed away 2 months ago, yeah, sorry.
Absolutely, yeah. Lawrence Ferlinghetti was there, Gregory Corso. And this Albert Hall event is a kind of meeting point between the sort of British and American underground poetry. And it's this real kind of galvanizing event. There's thousands of people there. And it becomes iconic. In some ways, it sort of kickstarts a lot of what we have now come to see as the 60s, broadly understood. And it turns into this wonderful documentary called Holy Communion. It becomes quite successful. It wins awards. And Whitehead then goes on to make a number of other documentaries over the 60s. But they become increasingly kind of conflicted. They become increasingly provocative. He gets more and more interested in ideas of violence, protest, similar to Nuttall in this sense, the way in which images, cameras, the media play into that. And he becomes, particularly towards the end of the 60s, when he was making a film called The Fall in New York, which is ostensibly about the slide of the protest movement into direct action, into a much more kind of violent, confrontational mode. He's interested in the way in which can he remain neutral as a documentarian? Is he kind of implicated in the violence that he sees? Can he sort of meditates and reflects on the idea of the camera as being some kind of weapon? It's that which you load and you shoot with it. And he gradually becomes involved in that which he's filming. So over his work over the course of the 60s, this brief but kind of incendiary body of work over the course, essentially the latter half of the 60s, becomes this kind of really powerful and potent index to the sort of sense of decline in terms of utopian hopes and sense of an increase in violence. And so it's a really useful resource, and he becomes a really interesting figure to chart that movement. But what I actually find most interesting about Whitehead is he then goes on through a series of kind of spectacular disappearances and reappearances. He kind of disappears out of view at the end of the 1960s. He kind of goes invisible. And then he starts to pop up in the strangest of circumstances, or kind of most unexpected of circumstances. He moves through France. He's sort of on the periphery of the Rolling Stones. He ends up making extremely odd films in a variety of French chateaux. And then he ends up being a sort of royal falconer to Prince Khalid Al-Faisal. And he has this incredible into the 1970s and 1980s incredible career as this sort of globe-trotting falconer. And then he disappears again, and then he reappears in the 1990s as this novelist or sort of visionary pseudo-magician who writes all these strange texts about his life in the 60s. And the whole life, the whole career is documented via a wonderful archive that I worked on for a number of years, which is now at De Montfort University here in the UK. So I was really keen to get some of Whitehead's story in the book, because he's this sort of lightning rod figure. He's always seems to be in the right place at the right time. He moves through all these sectors, all these scenes, and he's always documenting it, and he's always very sort of critical about his role in those scenes. And it's a really kind of interesting story. But he's this, I mean, I'm happy to talk more about him, because he's
I think it's interesting.
He's a magical figure.
Right, but he's done like all these documentaries. He did a documentary with Led Zeppelin. He was in London right at the peak of kind of like the new counterculture. He'd seen all these celebrities. So really a fascinating guy, not too well known, my understanding, here in the States. But yeah, if you want to expound some more on what he said and what he did, that'd be great.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I suppose the work that he's probably best known for is, as I said, this very long documentary called The Fall, and that's just had its 50th anniversary. And that's a really important piece for him, because that's really the piece where he's really assessing, it's really assessing his role as a filmmaker and the connection between his role as a filmmaker and counterculture is not the word that he uses. It's protest culture, the word that he uses. And he's fascinated by the way in which the protest culture, as he sees it, has been sort of co-opted and neutralized by the media. And he goes over to America. He's invited over to America in first of all, in 1967, and then later on in 1968, when he begins to sort of begin to put the film together. And he's initially invited to make a kind of poppy sort of... almost a kind of trailer film for kind of New York by Night. He'd recently made a film called Tonight Let's All Make Love in London, which pretty much laid down the language of the visual language of what we might associate with 60s and swinging London. It was sort of mods and nightclubs and changing of the guard and a kind of modish Englishness. And then there was a playfulness to it. I mean, it wasn't without seriousness, but there was a sort of modish playfulness to it. And he was initially invited to do something very similar for New York. This kind of an Englishman's view of the city that never sleeps. That was what was put to him. And he then started moving around the city, looking at all kinds of art events, looking at all kinds of performances. But he saw things being very kind of confused, very violent, very visceral. He spent a night going through Greenwich Village with the police. They were regaling him with tales of violence and murder and how the murder rate of New York was skyrocketing at the time. And then he became involved with the student protests around Columbia University. That then blossomed into an occupation. And he found himself actually in the occupied building, filming the events from the inside. And this was a sort of turning point between the shift from peaceful protest that had up until that point largely defined the anti-war movement, sectors of the counterculture. It's very much where we get those ideas of flower power from. It's flowers in gun barrels and so on and so forth. Whereas this was beginning to be a lot more militant, and the occupation was broken by violent intervention on the part of the police, and Whitehead films it all. He's there filming it all. And there's a wonderful sequence towards the end of the film, which, again, it's one of those sequences which really kind of sums up a lot of what I was trying to get at in the book, where the protesters are aware that they're about to have their occupation disrupted by the police. They're aware that they're about to be arrested. They're aware that this confrontation is probably going to be very violent. And they sort of give themselves to it, and they kind of celebrate it in some way. And they're dancing in this occupied office building. And then someone turns up with some bagpipes and starts playing. And you get this beautiful, droning, sort of wonderful, celebratory musical performance, which is so full of kind of ecstasy and joy and kind of hope. And then gradually you can hear a banging echoing down the corridors. And it's the police breaking through, and the music fades, and weapons appear, and these people who we then, the next time we see these people who've just been dancing and sort of celebrating themselves and their sort of commonality, their communality in this space, they're then sort of, they're bloodied and beaten and hurt and injured. And it suddenly becomes Night of the Living Dead, these kind of sort of zombified characters, these sort of walking corpses. And it's a really horrifying moment. Oh, in one sense, it works really well to show a sea change, and it's one of those kind of very powerful visual moments that seem to accumulate around 1969, which is like, here's the pivot point, here's where we go from peacefulness to violence. Here's another Altamont. Here's another Manson. But if you also step back from it, you can see elsewhere where, you know, this moment is only really a kind of metonym for a much wider scenario of violence and a much wider sense of discord that happens to come to a crisis moment at that point. And I think yeah. Weiss really understood that.
Yeah, but he saw it firsthand. So he's in the States for the murder of Martin Luther King, right? That's yeah. April 4th, 1968, then RFK.
Yeah.
And he's also following that same step that a lot of the left moved toward, direct kind of violent action, to, like from, I think it was the Students for Democratic Society to the Weathermen.
Yeah.
So all these characters. So he's seeing all of that. And yeah, it's pretty remarkable that he was there for that. Can you talk, was it Whitehead who was also involved in this kind of new kind of art actionism and destructivism? Was he experiencing that in New York at the time?
He experienced a little bit about it. I mean, he was very taken with a performance mounted by a group called the Destructivists. And this is a sort of central part of the film. And he saw one of their performances in New York, which involved the destruction, the kind of violent destruction of a piano, and also the destruction of a live chicken at the same time, the killing of a live chicken. And it's this extremely kind of aggressive and very disturbing moment. And there's a rationale behind this, and there's certainly a rationale behind the destructivists who saw their work as a kind of semi sort of shamanic process, this process of almost kind of ecstatic of sort of breaking down the body and its parameters. But there was also a kind of political intent to it as well. There was also a kind of sort of capitalistic critique going on in a lot of the work, and that tallies with a number of other sort of performers and groups that Whitehead was certainly aware of, but didn't film directly. But he was sort of putting the connections together himself. It mirrors the work of Gustav Metzger, the Destruction in Art Symposium, which was happening in the UK just a few years before Whitehead got to New York. And there's a parallel group in Vienna called the Vienna Actionists, who again engaged in these very sort of visceral, very bodily oriented, often public performance art, which involved bodily fluids, which involved what we now see as self-harm, which were set up to be, again, very provocative, self-consciously transgressive. But very much in the mold of the ideas that Jeff Nuttall was trying to get at in Bomb Culture. He talks about a lot of these artists as well, and he gathers a lot of these names together. That these artists were sort of working in sort of separate nodes, but it's sort of people like Jeff Nuttall who were bringing them together and sort of analyzing them together. And he saw them as these artists who were really trying to shock people out of a certain kind of insulated complacency, to realize and to think about the limits placed on the self, the way in which the self is at the mercy of and is constantly receiving all kinds of forces and forms of damage, and the way in which the sort of post-war society and culture is dealing with the kind of psychic damage of World War II and its immediate aftermath. You could draw a line from, say, North America right across Europe at the time, and you will be able to see these sort of parallel groupings of artists who are at the same time working through these ideas through forms of performance which are damaging, overtly destructive, and part of them is a sort of rejection of materialism. You have other forms of them, like artists like John Latham, who would be building towers that are designed to collapse, and towers of books that collapse. In one sense, there's a real kind of rejection of the material object, but in another sense, there's this really quite transgressive humanitarianism, I suppose, the one way to put it.
Right, and one of the interesting things I learned from your book is that Jodorowsky started out of those kind of art circles before he even made El Topo or The Holy Mountain, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sorry, I talked over you there, please.
Can, oh, you, okay. Can you just talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. Jodorowsky, before he met El Topo, he was involved in something called the Panic Movement, which was very much in the mold of the performers I've been describing, very much in the mold of the Vienna Actionists. And again, he's a, you know, he's someone who's working out of a very specific milieu. But it seems at the time to tally with what else is going on in these other contexts and other locations. And Panic Movement was, again, this idea to insert the body into this sense of performance. Jodorowsky was, his kind of take on the sort of theatrical moment was that it was very, very inauthentic. To purport to imitate something meant that you were moving away from a kind of essence, from a kind of authenticity. And he wanted to inspire the dramatic moment and the moment of performance with this real sense of bodily intensity. Some of this is coming from his own interests in ritual. Some of this is coming from his own interests in sort of magical practices, where there's a real sort of projection of the self and a projection of the will. And these performances would take the form of usually long, semi-improvised performances, which were sort of like psychodramas. Another way of seeing them would be happenings. They would be given a certain kind of organicness in the sense of let them go where they will. These are other performances, unfortunately, which involve the death of animals. Unfortunately, there's a lot of snakes, a lot of chickens who do not come off very well in these performances. Both the destructivists and the panic movement seem to have absolutely no problem in killing snakes and chickens on stage. And it often involved lots of nudity, essentially sex acts on stage. And it was a sense of allowing these performances and these moments, these authentic moments, to play themselves out to their fullest logic, to sort of burn out, if you like. And those ideas filter into Jodorowsky's filmmaking practice. El Topo is, in some ways, a sort of panic film. It's there to induce a kind of visceral response on the part of the viewer. It's not just sort of jarring in its kind of horrific content. It was meant to be something that would create a sort of intense sensory engagement. And I think its emergence and its popularity as a midnight movie was, I think, aided by that content. But I think the film gained, I think that also helped it to carry out that role, because it became a kind of event film that you would go and see at a certain place, at a certain time, when you were in a certain state. And all the sort of jarring imagery, the soundtrack, the incredibly vivid arterial spurts of blood that move all the way through that film, it's meant to be an attempt to kind of get beyond representation. That's what Jodorowsky was really interested in.
And I mean, talking about getting in the right state, I think the outside of the political chaos and cultural chaos, but the impact of LSD in the 60s, I think, was like an internal atomic bomb. Can you talk a little bit about how LSD became an important kind of tie between so many of the figures in your book, but also the kind of how it also, like, I think you wrote in your book, like, it could be positive, but also extremely negative experience. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, LSD has its own history as a substance. And we have people like Aldous Huxley and Timothy Leary to thank for its movement into the general populace. It obviously has this conspiratorial history as well, when we're thinking about the MK Ultra program and its use, alleged use by the CIA, when we're thinking about this resonance of it being a possible truth serum or a non-lethal weapon. But in terms of its filtration into what we might call the counterculture, LSD is a kind of primer for and a catalyst to what's broadly understood as the psychedelic experience. I'm sure this is all very familiar to your listeners. But what was kind of interesting me and the sort of angle that I was trying to take on it in the book, and the sort of resonances that I was trying to pick up on, is the kind of things that was coming out of Aldous Huxley's work, where he coined the term psychedelic with Humphrey Osmond, in order to get away from this sense that LSD was mimicking psychosis. They really disagreed with the idea that it was psychotomimetic, that it would sort of induce a kind of temporary madness or a temporary sense of derangement. For them, they had a much more kind of spiritual understanding of it. They felt that this was actually inducing almost, if you like, hitherto unknown, hitherto unexperienced altered states, a movement into another state of being, which we could parallel with or link to a spiritual experience. So it was not so much an imitator, but a generator of experience. And when we see the movement from LSD as a quote-unquote psychedelic drug into psychedelia, what we have with psychedelia is a range of cultural forms that are there to in some way approximate that experience, approximate that incredibly subjective and changeable experience with all those color gradations and different forms of distortion, so on and so forth. So it's in some ways an attempt to kind of make it manifest, but at the same time, it's a way to also generate further effects. It's a way to sort of play into the use of LSD. It's a case of, to use a quote from Spaceman 3, it's a case of taking drugs to make art to take drugs to, that it's part of this feedback loop where psychedelic music, psychedelic art is to attempt to represent these states, but induce them further if you engage with that while you are experiencing and having taken LSD. So I suppose where we might begin to see something of a kind of politics here, and I guess this is what the sort of direction that interested me when I was putting the book together, beyond the sort of intense sensory experiences and beyond the what we might see as the sort of pleasurable aspect of it, it's something that causes you to rethink your sense of self. It is something that causes you to radically rethink your sense of being, and by extension your kind of ontology. The visionary aspect of LSD, and by extension psychedelia, is not just a sense of thinking through sensory distortions that a substance creates. It sort of confronts you with the possibility of an other world, and I think that's what the countercultural impetus picked up on, the idea that it is possible to think and to imagine and to envisage another state of being, and LSD was a bridge to that. But the more sinister elements of it, and I think this is what we see in the Manson circle, is that that the movement to that other world requires, in some way, is built upon a certain opening of the self, a breaking down of certain barriers, say psychological resistance. It puts one into a potentially extremely vulnerable, a potentially very changeable state, and a potentially very receptive state. This is what Timothy Leary referred to when he was talking about set and setting, where you are when you take LSD, the mood you're in, the surrounding stimulus very much affects the nature of the experience that you go on to have. Someone like Manson seemed to understand this and would use the LSD both as a kind of sacrament, but also something that he could use to gain a degree of influence on those who made up the family. It would be kind of inscribed into their kind of routine, their kind of group mechanism. But Manson would also stand slightly back from taking it. He would observe the other members of the family take it, and that put him in a very strong programmatic role. He could manipulate things, he could programatize things. So it has enormous, if you like, visionary potential, and I think that leads to a kind of politics of inner space, that leads to a potentially utopian politics, because it does require you to rethink these normal parameters. But the darkness of it is not just the sort of potential sensory horror of what we might call a bad trip. The more it's the ethical and moral darkness linked to the possibility it opens for someone to significantly manipulate somebody else.
Right, and that was kind of one of the backdrops of LSD coming to the public. I think you wrote about a doctor in LA who said this shouldn't be brought out to mass usage. And Leary kind of was the counterpoint to that position and kind of seeded it out everywhere. I think it's also interesting that Huxley died same day as JFK taking LSD, you know, his wife is dripping in his mouth. But yeah, I think that just added to the craziness of that decade was this whole element of, you know, this political turmoil, but also throw in the LSD, and then almost becomes a loop. LSD creates more political turmoil. Is there anything else you'd like to cover? We're at about 45 minutes. Anything else you'd like to talk about your book as well?
I mean, I think the thing else that I think that might be of interest to your listeners, I think if we're thinking about the moving into potentially unfamiliar territory, again, just going back to the Whitehead material, Whitehead's a fairly, you know, he's a character whose work is gaining increased interest. But I don't just mention this just to harp on about the same topics. But he has a film that he makes in the later 1970s called Fire in the Water. And if anyone who's listening to this finds Whitehead interesting or finds some of the ideas that we've been talking about today interesting, I'd really recommend people to try and seek that out. It's quite obscure. It's not that easy to see, but there's quite a lot of writing about it. And it's a very interesting piece that comes at the very end of the period that I'm talking about in the book. He releases it after some delay in 1977. And in the way that the fall in the late 60s really kind of summed up, I think, some of the political discord. Fire in the Water, which is a much more intimate, much quieter film, much more solipsistic. It's about a sort of retreat of a Whitehead analog into a countryside location. But it becomes very intense and very hallucinatory towards the end of it. I think that kind of sums up what we were talking about just a moment ago about the psychedelic experience, about being, in terms of its political possibilities, about imagining another world. And I think, when you see Fire in the Water, there's nothing overtly there about LSD per se, but I would say that it's a very psychedelic film. Its visual language is perhaps not what we might expect of psychedelia. There's no neon sort of day glow colors. There's none of the kind of poster art that we might associate with it. But it's a film which is sort of profoundly interested in trying to hypothesize and think about moving beyond, going into another world, trying to revive things. And I think when I knew Whitehead, I knew him quite well, and when I was working on his archive, and he often didn't really speak about this film very much. He saw it as a kind of something of a coda, something of a kind of almost like an afterthought. And I think he didn't prioritize it and didn't really speak about it as much as these other films that he made during the 60s. But I think when I was re-watching it for this book and thinking over it again, it seemed to really tie a lot of things together. And I think it ultimately kind of crystallized a lot of what he was interested in doing. And it's also about how the filmmaking process can also be implicated in this psychic process of projecting oneself, of moving into another way of existence. So if our chat tonight has inspired anyone to think about Whitehead in relation to these themes, I'd really recommend that as something, as a kind of adventurous choice for people to seek out.
Gotcha. And he kind of just passed away recently too, 2019. He had a long, like you said, many chaptered life, right?
Yeah, right. We just lost him just recently. Yeah, it was sad to hear.
Yeah. So is there anything else you'd like to add or anything, contact information, where can people?
Yeah, I have my blog called Residual Noise, which there's lots of stuff on there in terms of the research that I do. There's lots of kind of sort of side notes to the book. There's a few things about the people that I've been writing about. I post there regularly, so anyone's very welcome to have a look at that and get in touch through there. And I am also on Twitter, at @endof60s. So despite all the things that I say about cults in the book, you're welcome to follow me via Twitter.
Awesome. So thanks so much for the interview. Really brilliant book. I highly recommend this book. Again, the title of the book is The Bad Trip, Dark Omens, New Worlds, and the End of the 60s by James Riley. James, thank you so much.
Thank you, William. My pleasure.
All right, bye-bye. Still there?
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.